But I'm here today because I believe Facebook's products harm children, stoke division, and weaken our democracy. We can have social media we enjoy that connects us without tearing our apart our democracy, putting our children in danger, and sowing ethnic violence around the world.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Backstory. I'm Dana Lewis. What you just heard was Frances Haugen, a former employee of Facebook, now turned whistleblower, testifying to a Senate committee. She ripped Facebook management, accusing them of knowingly placing profit over the safety of children and young girls, and for allowing the spread of political division and ethnic hatred rather than policing its own platform, all in the name of the bottom line. The Senate hearing was a turning point, say politicians who want to regulate the internet giant. But here's the most stunning thing Haugen said, in my opinion. A fundamental issue is that Facebook's advertising-based business model needs to keep people on its platform for as long as possible, and the company exploits negative emotions to achieve that. Translation: hate keeps people on Facebook longer, she suggests, and hate is good for business, which later Mark Zuckerberg denied in a statement. On this backstory, does Haugen's revelations really change anything on Facebook or Instagram for you or for your children? The author of a book called Anti-Social Media, How Facebook Disconnects Us and Undermines Democracy, says change won't come easily. And maybe not at all. All right, Professor Siva Vaidyanathan is the head of Deliberate Media Lab. He's the director of the Center for Media and Citizenship Media Studies at the University of Virginia. Hi, Siva.
Hi, it's good to speak to you today.
I wanted to get all that in there. So, look, did you watch the testimony?
I did, in bits and pieces, yes, yes.
I found it quite jarring, some of it, what she had to say in very simple terms. So for more than 3 hours before a Senate subcommittee, Frances Haugen, who worked for Facebook's civic misinformation team for nearly 2 years until May, when they did away with the misinformation team, which is incredible, I think, to anyone, essentially said that Facebook has been hiding disturbing research about how teenagers felt worse about themselves after using its product, and how it's willing to use hateful content on its site to keep users coming back. I mean, right. That's a devastating charge at Facebook.
Yes, absolutely. Look, Ms. Haugen was very blunt, very clear, and was also sophisticated in her criticism of Facebook. She made it clear that it's not as if there are people at Facebook who want people to do harm to each other or want to do harm in general. It's that Facebook's prime value is increased user numbers and increased engagement, right? So everything at Facebook is geared toward getting more people to use Facebook and Instagram for more hours of the day, for more reasons in their lives. That is their primary directive. It's been so since day one. That's why they spend so much money generating more users in places where they make no money, places like sub-Saharan Africa, places like Southeast Asia, some of the poorest countries in the world. Facebook has done a tremendous amount to try to hook people into the system, knowing that over time, you know, if those economies get stronger, if people develop credit cards, that can pour money in later. But even if it doesn't, Facebook's goal, Mark Zuckerberg's goal for Facebook is
so really,
to be really, the most influential.
That's called capitalism, by the way. It's not a bad thing to get people to use your platform as much as possible. The problem becomes in the how.
Yeah. It's a different sort of capitalism because it's not really about revenue. So, and this is where Ms. Haugen and I disagree or separate. It's not about revenue. It's not about making more money. Money has always taken care of itself at Facebook. It's a bizarre upside down world, very unlike other companies. It's run ideologically and run idealistically. Mark Zuckerberg truly believes that the world will be better if more people use Facebook for more things. He believes that if we use Facebook to connect to each other, to commune with each other, we will have better mutual understanding, greater tolerance. Of course, there's plenty of human history to show that that's complete bunk, right?
Doesn't appear to be neighbors working out recently anyway.
Exactly. Neighbors kill each other. Neighbors are at war for centuries, right? Families kill each other, right? There's no reason to think that connection and familiarity breed mutual respect or better behavior, right? It's a much complex problem of that. But Mark Zuckerberg is a naive person who believes in the power of technology over any human complications. He doesn't think of us as full human beings. He thinks of us as mere playthings within Facebook. And he wants all of us to be engineered by the way Facebook is designed because he believes it's better for us. He wants what's best for us if what's best for us is Mark Zuckerberg's vision of life. Now, it just so happens.
Let's just stop there for a second because you would be giving him the benefit of the doubt on a lot of things there, saying that he thinks it's good for us and that he's naive. And Ms. Haugen's testimony yesterday says this guy's not naive. They operate intentionally in the shadows behind a wall because they know very well that Facebook fuels itself in part by spreading hatred, and that hatred keys you to spend more time on the platform and to click more and to stay with them more, and that equals advertising revenue.
So the top people at Facebook see that as a glitch in the system that can be fixed at its margins and not a function of how Facebook is designed, right? So the people at the top of Facebook who saw these reports and have heard the criticism, they can easily box it up and dismiss it because they will not be shaken by their true belief, right? This is an ideologically driven organization where they truly believe they're making the world better. It's like a cult at the top. Now, it just so happens that it's a very highly paid set of cult leaders, as cult leaders are often highly paid, right? But in this case, all the evidence in the world has not swayed them, right? They're supposed to be a data-driven company, but they ignore their own data if it's inconvenient or if it gets in the way of the long-term goal. They are willing to let teenage girls starve themselves, cut themselves, and maybe kill themselves as long as acting to prevent that doesn't reduce the growth of Instagram and Facebook. That's their thing. They are willing to accept the pain at the margins.
And apparently they know very well how that happens and that they have a much better, much clearer map of how these things happen. These harmful social side effects happen inside Facebook than they would make out publicly.
That's the thing. And this is really what the key here is. Facebook leaders have been duplicitous again and again and again. Now, Ms. Haugen did a really clever thing. This has often been lost in the conversations here. She filed complaints with the Securities and Exchange Commission of the U.S. government. This is the instrument of the U.S. government that is in charge of preventing securities fraud. It is against the law for a leader of a company to mislead investors about the value of the company and risks to the value of the company. And these documents clearly show that Mark Zuckerberg and other top leaders of the company have actively misled the public about the dangers occurring through and with Facebook and about therefore the dangers to the company's reputation, right? Once the company's reputation has been hurt, which it certainly has even more now, you know, investors, stockholders should be saying, wait a minute, why didn't you tell us this was a risk? The Facebook stock has dropped. It'll go back up eventually because it makes so much money, but it's dropped in the past few weeks. So many Facebook investors, including big institutions, lost a lot of money this week if they were too heavy on Facebook. That is an indication that the Securities and Exchange Commission should be looking at Facebook and specifically at Mark Zuckerberg for misleading investors. So she's managed to protect herself by doing that, and she's managed to generate yet one more potential legal risk for Facebook and Mark Zuckerberg personally.
What do you know about Frances Haugen that maybe many of us don't know? I mean, she seems like she has a lot of people possibly behind her, and that there is a network of people who have been trying to kick in the door to Facebook for a long time to get into the algorithm and to try to understand how they do business and to understand their internal studies. And suddenly it would seem that she's not one person standing alone.
I do know that she has a team of lawyers who are very smart and she's probably working with some public relations professionals who are also very smart. The way this whole campaign has worked has been really clever. It started with anonymous leaks to the Wall Street Journal. The Wall Street Journal ran four consecutive articles revealing all the problems here, all the ways in which Facebook executives have known problems but have ignored problems. That gave the country and the world about 2 weeks to digest the substance of the reports. And there was a lot of coverage and a lot of discussion. But, you know, that just happens at the level of elite journalism. Then Sunday night, she appears on 60 Minutes. Now, clearly, she and her people had already cleared the 60 Minutes appearance and scheduled it with the Senate committee hearing. So she's managed to have to create attention and headlines to the substantive problems in the Wall Street Journal 2 weeks ago, gave it a week to get out into the world, and then followed up with a 60 Minutes appearance, which then puts her on television screens before millions of Americans. That's powerful. And she spoke so clearly, so succinctly, so powerfully. It was the best performance I've ever seen of any Facebook critic.
Right.
And then she follows up with her Senate testimony, which was also rather succinct and stirring.
There may be some staging here, but that doesn't take away any of her credibility.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, I mean, she clearly has the credibility, having worked in data science, having worked for these companies before, having been hired for the specific purpose of making Facebook safer and better. At this point in time, I see that she is, a bit of a hero. She's certainly not only taken some risks, but she has done so rather cleverly. Now, there may be other parties behind her, right? Facebook has other enemies in the industry and other enemies in Silicon Valley, and there may be some support from them. I don't know that would undermine her message either. The reports are the reports, right? The documents are the documents. And this is what I fear is now that the attention is on her, who she is, what she did, it might detract a bit from the substance of the reports, which she says, of course, she did not work on. She had access to them, just as the top leadership of Facebook had access to them. And her complaint is, why didn't you read it? And if you did read it, why didn't you act? How can you sleep at night? That's a really powerful argument. So I would wish that our conversation would stay on the substance of what Facebook Research, an instrument of Facebook, an office within Facebook, has been working on for years. They've done very good work. I wish their work were publicized. I wish their work were published by Facebook. It would make a huge difference. Unfortunately, Facebook is very secretive.
Because it's damning?
You know, they don't even produce the data of reports that might alleviate their stress or make themselves look better. They are a very secretive organization because they believe that only they can understand what's going on. It comes from arrogance mostly rather than fear.
Just see, to help me do away with a naive notion that many of us have about these big platforms. And that is when they shrug their shoulders and say, yeah, there's hatred on there. But it is in the amount that is overwhelming and we can't deal with it, but we are trying. We are hiring people and we are slowly trying to tackle the problem, whether it be racism or terrorism, ultranationalism, or what's the reality? Is that true? Or is there a wink and a nod? Let this run, because that's what fires part of the platform.
It's difficult to say.
What do you suspect?
Well, no one at Facebook has explicitly said this is too big a problem for us to tackle. What they've said is we're trying our best, we care, and we're hiring a lot of people to do it. What they won't admit is that Facebook is too big to govern. That's too dangerous a place to go. And that's simply the truth. 3 billion people use Facebook regularly, and they use it in more than 110 languages. Facebook just doesn't have the staff, nor will it ever have the staff.
Why are they scared to admit that they're too big to govern? Where does that lead us?
That leads us to the terrifying truth that it is one of the most powerful companies in the history of the world. And that is just too much for people to keep in their heads. And they're really concerned. They like to have the impression that they're like this small, nimble startup, right? And just arrived on the scene and kids love us, right? And the fact that it is a communication company that reaches 3 billion people out of 7.6 billion people on Earth, that it coordinates our social relations, that it it's the lens through which we see much of the world. That is too much power for Facebook to want us to recognize.
So what do you do? Like, do you regulate it or do you break it up? Or what? Where does that
road lead? We don't have any tools. We don't have any regulatory tools that will do the job. And break it up doesn't really mean anything. I mean, what does that mean? Spin off Instagram so there are two evil, terrible companies? That's not better. That's just twice as bad, right? Competition never really fixes anything. It's a sort of naive belief in markets.
Well, Haugen herself said in the Senate testimony, she said, regulate it, declare moral bankruptcy, admit that you can't deal with it if you're inside Facebook, and let in, I don't know who, but I assume she means the universities, the professionals who can really get inside and then maybe regulate it with fines if they're unable and incapable.
So the problem is we lack the regulatory structure to do any of that. Most in the United States, most of the regulations that might make a difference would be stifled by the First Amendment or stifled by other interests in other industries. You know, a lot of regulations that would apply to Facebook and limit what they can do would also apply to insurance companies and Walmart and the Wall Street Journal itself. And there would be significant lobbying opposition to anything that, for instance, restricted the accumulation of personal data for marketing, right? Because so many companies and so many industries depend on that. But that would be the thing. That's the food that feeds the beast. If we could restrict data acquisition and analysis and the uses to which data were put, that would be powerful. That would strike at the heart of not only Facebook, but also Google and many other companies. It would re-deliver return autonomy to people in some important ways. But that also means going up against basically every major industry in the country. Are we up for that just because we hate Facebook? Now, you know, I'm not optimistic that there's
I'm up for it.
Okay, you might be.
Analytica unfold in the UK, and I understand that they absolutely accessed all sorts of data, sexual data, very personal data, and sold it off. And then it was used as a political tool to undermine democracy. And in fact, I know a guy who wrote a book. It was called Anti-Social Media, How Facebook Disconnects Us and Undermines Democracy, written by
you. Absolutely. It is an emergency, right? It is an emergency that across the world we must confront, but we don't have the tools to do it. This is how bad it is, right? That Facebook is so powerful and that we've missed so many opportunities over the past decade and a half to do something about this because we would not listen until now, right? It took all of the most recent events to get this sort of public awareness, but there's still not political will or clarity on what any country might do. And let's remember, we are talking about hundreds of countries there, right? We are talking about India, which has 300 million Facebook users. It's the largest market for Facebook. And that's 300 million out of 1.2 billion people. The potential for growth in India is significant. So, you know, with all of that, it's really important to remember that governments are very weak when dealing with these global corporations. We've not been able to do anything about Exxon or Shell. You know, they continue to run rampant and destroy the world in a much more direct fashion. And yet we do nothing about them. You know, we talk a lot. So, like, let's not get our hopes up. We're not good at this. Corporations run our lives. This is yet another of them. We have not summoned the will or created the means.
I guess we really are. But we really are at a critical juncture in terms of development of democracies and even what happened at the Capitol in the U.S.
Right.
Social media is turning our world upside down. So we better get inside this. And nobody can say the alarm bells haven't been ringing for years now, not months.
Exactly. But we still lack the tools. We need to be bolder and more creative about and more forceful about retaking control of our lives and our minds and reestablishing a way that we might actually deliberate about important public issues in an informed and sober way. We've lost that ability. And that's a fundamental ability that makes democratic republics possible. We don't have that anymore to the extent we ever did. And it's getting worse because the devices we have and the platforms we have just fracture our attention, divide our beliefs, and make it harder and harder to deliberate. So we're in big trouble on a number of fronts. And I don't think we've taken the problem seriously enough. And we keep looking for these easy answers. We keep looking to the 20th century and invoking 20th century tools to address a set of problems we have never seen before.
Why isn't it as easy as getting inside Facebook, opening up the algorithm and understanding how they pound and distribute some of the disturbing material that feeds Facebook?
And so two things. One, there's no mystery about how they do it. They've always been very open about what they do. So that's not, it's not a knowledge problem. But for, let's just say, the U.S. government to do anything about that kind of process would violate the First Amendment, because we are talking about what we would be, what the government would be telling a private corporation it can and cannot express. Because algorithms are functions of expression, right? And they decide, algorithms decide what gets expressed. So in the United States, we cannot regulate algorithms like that. It's just not possible.
Last question to you, and I thank you for your time. I got the impression at the end of that Senate subcommittee, bipartisan support existed for moving on Facebook, that was it. We have turned a corner, and some of the senators were saying, you know, Facebook is not going to be allowed to run the way it was anymore.
Well, there's a big difference between sentiment and substance, right? And what you saw was sentiment congeal, but what you didn't see was any reasonable substantive response that is likely to go forward and likely to make a difference. What is possible, it won't be effective. What would be effective is currently not possible.
Professor Siva Vaidyanathan from the Media Studies Department at the University of Virginia. Siva, thank you. And by the way, I looked at a couple of your videos on YouTube where you talk about the history of the internet and how did we get here? And I would recommend those to anyone. And I'm definitely going to read your book. And I really do appreciate your insight.
My pleasure. Good to talk to you.
Thank you, sir. And that's our backstory this week. Regulating Facebook and Instagram and all the others is very complex. They have access to some of the most sensitive personal data, and government can't be given the right to regulate that or even access all of it, even though Facebook sells it. Yet without access to Facebook's data, how do outside researchers recommend reforms to limit the dark side of engagement? The discussion will keep going. For me, Haugen's revelations about Facebook not having the staff to regulate content was already obvious. Where I think she changed the discussion was her charge that Facebook and its engagement thrives on conflict and anger and negative emotions. And if people who run it really do exploit that, surely that warrants huge fines from regulators in America and in Europe.
The company intentionally hides vital information from the public, from the U.S. government, and from governments around the world. The documents I have provided to Congress prove that Facebook has repeatedly misled the public about what its own research reveals about the safety of children, the efficacy of its artificial intelligence systems, and its role in spreading divisive and extreme messages. We can afford nothing less than full transparency. As long as Facebook is operating in the shadows, hiding its research from public scrutiny, it is unaccountable. Until the incentives change, Facebook will not change. My fear is that without action, divisive and extremist behaviors we see today are only the beginning. What we saw in Myanmar and are now seeing in Ethiopia are only the opening chapters of a story so terrifying, no one wants to read the end of it.
I'm Dana Lewis. Thanks for listening to Backstory. Please share our podcast, and I'll talk to you again soon.